Welcome to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and we're doing something a little different for y'all this week. We're revisiting some of our favorite deep dives, along with my partner in sonic information exploration, Dorian Warren. Now today, Dorian and I are getting into all things health insurance. And don't worry, it's going to be fun and educational. Now heads up, we taped this back in January, when the Omicron variant was wreaking havoc, and Dorian had just returned to the States from New Zealand. Well, I was just a little bit jealous. Anyway, enjoy. Welcome, everybody. This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. And for the first time in this new year, I'm joined by my friend, Dorian Warren. Now, maybe you remember Dorian is co-president of Community Change, co-chair of the Economic Security Project. And of course, Dorian is my co-host for The Takeaway Deep Dive. It is so good to have you back, man.
Hey, Melissa, it's great to be back on The Takeaway. I really, really missed y'all, seriously.
Okay, so I missed you too, but I didn't just miss you. I have been hating on you because I've been over here freezing, a particularly cold winter, and you flipped the script and have been enjoying sunshine and blue skies in New Zealand?
Yes, and let me say the weather was fantastic. But Melissa, the biggest difference, honestly, was the pandemic. Omicron was ripping through communities, filling hospitals to capacity back home in the U.S., at the same time that I was feeling what it was like to live in an almost COVID-free nation. Yes, New Zealand has held off COVID for nearly 2 years. And up until earlier this week, the country had suffered less than 16,000 cases and fewer than 60 deaths since the start of the pandemic. Now, granted, that's in a population of 5 million, but still, it's literally a different world.
But I was reading the news, and that kind of changed a bit this week, right?
Indeed. Omicron arrived just this week, and because we know that this variant is so contagious, the country is bracing for its highest infection rates of the entire pandemic. But with 76% of the population fully vaccinated, and the government taking swift and strict measures, it's unlikely, Melissa, that Omicron will be as deadly in New Zealand as it's been here in the United States.
And you're not kidding about those swift measures. I read that the prime minister actually canceled her wedding due to the rising cases. And I mean, man, that's at the same time and a pretty stark contrast to our former vice presidential candidate, Sarah Palin. She was unable to even proceed with a lawsuit where she was supposed to appear because she is still unvaccinated and COVID positive again.
Listen, the prime minister did indeed cancel her wedding, where famous Kiwi singer Lorde was set to perform. And since you mentioned her, Melissa, let me say definitively that the differences between Sarah Palin and Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern are too numerous to count. I mean, we don't have all morning here. So this is not just about national leadership in this pandemic moment. The contrast between the U.S. and New Zealand experiences of COVID are rooted in history and different policy choices. New Zealand has publicly funded health insurance that achieved universal health coverage back in the 1940s.
Yo, whoa.
Well, this doesn't mean there are no inequalities in the system, but it does mean that every citizen can be treated in public hospitals, and all citizens have insurance.
Okay, so I get it. When a global pandemic hits a nation with more than 8 decades of universal health insurance coverage, then the outcome is pretty different than when it arrives in a nation like ours that has a patchwork of this kind of insufficient and inequitable health insurance. I think that's exactly the reason why it is the right time for a deep dive of American health insurance.
For your health.
For your health.
For your health.
My name is Julia Lynch. I'm a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania.
We asked Professor Lynch to compare the U.S. system of health insurance to others in the world. And she pointed not down under to New Zealand, but across the pond to Denmark.
Denmark has in place a whole range of policies that go from healthcare to a bunch of policies well outside the healthcare system, like paid sick leave, supports for businesses.
Now, of course, Denmark's population is just shy of 6 million people, and most of them are ethnic Danes, whereas the U.S. population is more like 329 million. And we are, of course, a people from very diverse racial and ethnic backgrounds.
So one thing to keep in mind is that while the original sort of social insurance and social safety nets and welfare states in places like the Scandinavian countries developed at a time when these countries were really racially homogeneous, unlike the United States. These societies have continued to develop and their welfare states have continued to develop as they've become more multiracial. They have in many cases held on to those original ideas of social solidarity and original policies that have been very solidaristic.
In short, a nation's system of health insurance is what we'd call path dependent, which basically means that where we are today is a result of where we began and each decision that we made along the way. So to understand now, we're going to have to start with before.
Okay, so let's begin in the U.S. South at the close of the Civil War. Newly emancipated Black Americans are facing displacement, disease, and a devastating smallpox pandemic. In response, Congress established our nation's first federal healthcare program, the Medical Division of the Freedmen's Bureau. It was small and under-resourced, but these 120 doctors and 40 ramshackle hospitals across the South represented the very first time the federal government tried to provide health care to the American people. And this was during a period we know as Reconstruction. Of course, it didn't last. The short Reconstruction period of our experiment with multiracial democracy, of course, didn't last. But specifically, Melissa, lawmakers ended the Freedmen's Medical Division, arguing that this free medical care was breeding dependency.
That origin story explains a lot about national attitudes towards a universal system of healthcare.
Mm-hmm, but wait, because there's more. Fast forward to the turn of the 20th century. There's no health insurance or hospital system. If you called your doctor, you paid from your own pocket. By the 1920s, medical practitioners became more professional and their services became more expensive. Then in 1929, a group of school teachers in Dallas got together and contracted with Baylor University Hospital. The teachers paid 50 cents every month. And then if they got sick and needed to go to the hospital, they had access to inpatient hospital care.
I mean, wait, isn't that basically how health insurance works?
Yep. This was the nation's first private health insurance. And within a decade, dozens of similar plans emerged. They then formed a single organization called, and wait for it, Melissa, Blue Cross.
Stop it. So I can thank some well-organized school teachers in 1929 Texas for this Blue Cross Blue Shield card in my wallet?
Well, actually, Blue Shield started out a bit differently. Primary care doctors didn't want to give all the control over to hospitals, so they created a separate network of insurance called the Blue Shield. And for decades, people would buy Blue Cross for their hospital insurance and Blue Shield for their medical insurance. Back in 1982, the two merged. So Melissa, that is why your hospital card has Blue Cross and Blue Shield on it.
Okay, yo, I know I said path dependent, but this is one long winding path.
It is, but stick with me for just one more curve in this historical road, because I'm betting that you got that health insurance card from your employer.
Oh yeah, just 2 weeks ago, a shiny new one at the start of every January.
Exactly, because employer provided health insurance also has a history, one rooted in World War II. With young men fighting overseas during the war, a labor shortage drove up wages and inflation. And to cool down the economy, the federal government froze wages in 1942. Now, to attract workers, businesses, and with the labor movement as a willing partner, started providing health insurance. In 1943, the IRS made employer-based health insurance tax-exempt. So suddenly, the cheapest way to get health insurance was at your job. And those policy decisions created our unusual and what some would say exceptional system of employment-based health insurance. Another example, Melissa, of path dependency that you just mentioned.
And as you're walking through that, I'm realizing that, you know, you're getting us right there back to the 1940s, the same time 80 years ago when New Zealand established universal health care coverage through a single-payer system. That's the same moment when the U.S. is instantiating this employer-dependent system of at least two different kinds of blue private insurance. Professor Julia Lynch also explained that our current system is a patchwork of public and private insurance.
private insurance is a wonderful thing if you have good private insurance. But I think it's really important to remember that a third of health insurance spending in the United States is actually by public insurance programs like Medicare, Medicaid, and the Veterans Administration health system.
And the patterns of that patchwork, well, they're predictable.
About 60% of working age whites have employer-based coverage, so private health insurance. But that's only true for a little less than half of Blacks and around 40% of Latinos. So when we think about what are the public insurance programs in the United States and who do they serve, overall, about 20% of working age adults have primarily public health insurance. So that's going to be mostly Medicaid and insurance that they have as a result of their veteran status. People over the age of 65 are more likely to have Medicare. About half of poor families have public insurance, and a quarter of near poor. So just to give you one more number that always surprises me, about 40% of babies who are born in the United States are in fact covered by Medicaid.
My name is Jamila Michener. I'm an associate professor of government and public policy at Cornell University and co-director of the Cornell Center for Health Equity.
We asked Professor Michener to tell us more about Medicaid.
Medicaid is our nation's health insurance program predominantly for low-income people, so people who are living in or near poverty. And that's really the core of the program, is that it provides people who have a low income with health insurance. And so it serves pretty economically marginalized and vulnerable populations. And it's supposed to be an avenue for insuring those folks and giving them access to healthcare and by virtue of that, to the chance to live healthy lives.
And much like other parts of the health insurance system, Medicaid is fragmented.
It's a different program in different states. It's really not one program. It's 50 different programs, and we've designed it to be that way. But that means that people have lots of different kinds of experiences with it, some dehumanizing and stigmatizing, and some great and positive. And those experiences affect the way they think about and engage the government.
And because our private insurance system is tied to employment, I asked Professor Michener, do these people work?
Yes. I laugh because I know you're asking the question with a bit of irony, but I couldn't tell you how many people, policymakers included, I talk to who are not asking that question with irony, but really mean it. So, you know, in many states, over 50% of beneficiaries are children, so they're clearly not working. A sizable chunk of beneficiaries are people who have disabilities of various sorts, and so they're not working because they cannot work. Somewhere around 10 or 11% of beneficiaries are elderly, and so they're people who also we don't expect to be working because they're out, they've aged out of the workforce. But among the group of people who have Medicaid and also fit into demographic life categories where we would expect them to be working, the vast majority of those people do in fact work.
Okay, so this system might be complex with private insurance for some, Medicare for the elderly, Medicaid for the poor. But in 2020, 91% of Americans had at least some form of health insurance. So even if it's not pretty, it seems like it works, but it turns out it's not that simple.
The federal government and state governments, unfortunately, reimburse the care for Medicaid patients at a much lower rate than for patients with other kinds of insurance. So, for example, if you have Medicare, our nation's program for elderly people who are 65 and over, doctors are going to get reimbursed at much higher rates for your care if you have Medicare. And if you have private insurance, they'll also get better reimbursement. But if you have Medicaid, you're going to get those services from doctors or hospitals, and those service providers are going to get reimbursed at much lower rates. That disincentivizes them accepting Medicaid patients because they're getting less money for those patients. So in a system like, unfortunately, the system we have, where part of what motivates the system is profit, By not reimbursing for Medicaid patients at as high as a rate as you do for other kinds of patients, what it means is that it makes it more difficult for Medicaid beneficiaries to access the system because there are fewer doctors that are willing to accept Medicaid patients. And many doctors will have a cap on how many Medicaid patients they accept.
Just think about that. As a nation, we abandon a nascent system of public health delivery because the first beneficiaries were Black, formerly enslaved, new citizens. And instead, our system is forged in the fire of capital and competition. And even today, our system pits those with public and private insurance on an unequal footing in the competition to access healthcare.
I think the one thing that I would really want people to understand is that the inequalities in health that we see are really the product of history, and they are baked into policies that really go far beyond healthcare. So this means things like redlining and other forms of disinvestment from communities of color, practices of policing and incarceration that you've talked a lot about on this show, even things like environmental policy. Poor communities have higher levels of particulate matter in the air from pollution, and this leads to worse educational outcomes and greater vulnerability to COVID. So I think when we think about health equity in the United States and the role that health insurance plays, we can't ignore these other really long-standing policy choices that make certain communities just more vulnerable to illness to begin with.
Listen, I'm still reeling from how Professor Michener explained that medical reimbursement rates depend on the source of your insurance. I mean, I guess I vaguely understood this, but something about how she explained it blew my mind. Wait a minute. Things cost what they cost, right? Like, are you telling me that what our health providers are paid and what our procedures cost is set by insurance companies? How long has this been happening?
Yeah. You know, if only it were as simple as it costs what it costs, and then that's what you get paid for, is just you get paid for what it's cost. But many states, especially for programs like Medicaid, they pay for benefits on what's called a fee-for-service basis, right? And so under this model, you pay directly for a covered service. And so based on what the service is, the amount that you're willing to pay, especially that the government is willing to pay, is kind of predetermined based on what the service is, right? And so those rates are a product of negotiation and compromise over really what is a long period of time, in part by the government, but largely by the providers, who are often setting the terms and often have a lot of pull and play in the political processes that determine what kinds of fees you get for what kinds of services.
So basically, our health insurance card is like, it's like our zip code. It's our neighborhood, right? Like, so if you have a 3-bedroom, 2-bath house in good neighborhood A, then you're going to get a lot more for it than in bad neighborhood B, even if it's the exact same house, right? So you're telling me that our current health insurance system is basically created residential segregation by insurance type?
Yeah, people. This is why people call it a multi-tiered healthcare system. It's certainly a healthcare system where your care is rationed based on your income.
So who does this benefit?
I mean, the system as it stands absolutely benefits the folks like Blue Cross Blue Shield, even if they're in some ways paying higher rates. They also have a lot of the market share, and they have the ability to negotiate with providers and with health systems to get rates and other kinds of structures that are favorable for them and for their bottom line. And they can determine how much they're charging for their product in the market, how much they're charging for copays, how much they're charging for premiums, how much they have a lot more levers for making profit in a profit-based system like this. And so these are not the folks that are going to be rallying for a system that is more equitable and more universal and not profit-based. The profit-based system that we currently have is making them billions upon billions upon billions of dollars, even as healthcare costs are exploding. The government, on the other hand, has limited levers for getting more revenue and resources for a program like Medicaid or a program like Medicare. That's why they have limits in terms of how much they can pay and how much they can reimburse, because they can't just up the prices because there are no prices. So, you know, the government programs are in a much more limited position and end up as a result having to make choices that aren't good for the beneficiaries of those programs. But the folks on the private side, it may sound like they're not benefiting from this scenario, but if you think about the system as a whole, they are absolutely benefiting from a healthcare system that is high cost, extremely high cost, and profit driven.
Right? Who are the people who are not benefiting from the way our system is set up?
People who don't have a lot of income suffer, and they end up having to just take whatever they can get, whether it's the lowest grade private health insurance or the health insurance that you get from the government. Now, of course, programs like Medicaid are really important, and they're helping tons of people who otherwise would have no other options. But there are also ways that programs like that are just not providing people with the same level of access always that someone who has the best private insurance would have. It doesn't have to be that way.
Is this system fixable?
Absolutely. The system is fixable. I mean, because we built the system, so we can change it, right? And for a very long time, we have been making the wrong choices, choices that prioritize profit and that emphasize the voice, perspectives, and preferences of corporations and of economic interest, elite economic interest. And because we have chosen to give disproportionate political voice to those interests, we've ended up with a system that's profit-based and rationed based on your economic ability to pay. We can very well design a different system, but we'd also have to have a different kind of politics that put priority on different things. For example, human dignity over profit or the market. And we'd also need to center and amplify the political voices of a different set of actors, right? But if we were to make what would be some pretty transformative political changes, but entirely possible, especially if we think over the medium and long term, if we were to make those political changes, we could get a system that looked very different and that actually served the needs of everyone and that actually met the needs of the most vulnerable and the most marginalized. It's not what we have now, but that doesn't mean we can't have it.
Each election season, political memoirs abound, doorstops that sometimes divulge more than intended.
No matter how diligently they present themselves in the most electable light, they always reveal themselves, their insecurities, their fears, their ambitions.
How to read a Politico on this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
Dorian, I'm struck that so much of what we've discussed points to the deep and persistent inequities in our system. But I appreciated that Professor Jamila Michener gave us reason to hope.
The system is fixable, I mean, because we built the system, so we can change it, right?
Hope. Change. Melissa, where have I heard those words before?
Okay, well played, Mr. Warren. And you're right. In our very recent past, our nation made some big changes in our system of health insurance. But the path to that change was a stony road to trod, which is undoubtedly why then Vice President Biden was irrepressibly enthusiastic about passage of the Affordable Care Act back in 2010.
Mr. President, you've done what generations of not just ordinary, but great men and women have attempted to do. Everybody knows the story, starting with Teddy Roosevelt. They've tried. They were real bold leaders. But Mr. President, they fell short. You have turned, Mr. President, the right of every American to have access into decent health care into reality for the first time in American history.
In many ways, the ACA was transformative. It expanded health coverage to 20 million Americans. It created protections for people with pre-existing conditions. It made sure that insurance covered preventive care and screenings. And it established competitive private health insurance exchanges that have helped to manage healthcare costs. It really was what Vice President Biden said about it at the time.
Yep, a big bleeping deal.
To gain a little insight into the process of crafting the Affordable Care Act, we sat down with one of its architects, Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, who is now Vice Provost of Global Initiatives at the University of Pennsylvania.
Well, it is a big deal. There are 22 million Americans who got healthcare coverage. I will tell you, many, many people stop me on the street when they recognize who I am and the fact that I worked on the Affordable Care Act and thank me. Sometimes they tell me particular stories like, I got a heart transplant because you passed the Affordable Care Act. That's obviously an exaggeration, but those are true stories. There are people who got medical services that they could not have gotten because of the Affordable Care Act. We had about 45 to 50 million Americans without health insurance, and that was growing, not declining, and it was getting more expensive. Second, we had growing costs that were growing about double the underlying rate of inflation, maybe even more in some years, just going up and up and up, and with many consequences for the federal government, consequences for states because they had to pay for Medicaid and it was impinging on their ability to fund primary education, state colleges, and other things. And then we had inconsistent and uneven quality. I think people who worked on it, especially those of us in the White House and many of the people on the Hill, getting fairness, getting people who'd been excluded from the system without insurance, couldn't easily access a doctor or a hospital, that was very high on our minds. We wanted people to get coverage because we thought it was the right thing to do. People had a right to health insurance. It was integral to being a citizen. It's important to make sure that people don't just have health insurance, but they also have access to high quality care. One of the things COVID has revealed is that while we might have made some progress on that through the Affordable Care Act, there's still a lot of differences between hospitals, say, in inner city and minority areas, or hospitals in rural areas and maybe the best academic hospitals or the best private hospitals in the country. I would also say that my colleagues were strongly dedicated to getting universal coverage, getting it as wide as possible, trying to control healthcare costs because they were very much weighing on people, and you know, just trying to get people the care that they needed at the highest quality we could obtain for everyone.
And as much fun as it is to travel back to March 2010 at that enthusiastic moment of passage, we can't stop there because signing the ACA into law was just the beginning. In January 2017, the Congressional Research Service published a report detailing 70 Republican-led attempts to repeal, modify, defund, or limit the Affordable Care Act.
They have to repeal the budget-busting bills like Obamacare.
Oppose the individual mandate. Oppose Obamacare.
To repeal Obamacare.
I don't like the Obamacare plan.
Repeal whatever is left of Obamacare.
Repeal every single word of Obamacare.
70 congressional actions against the law. I mean, it makes those Harry and Louise ads against the Clinton health care reform attempt in 1994 seem mild by comparison.
The government may force us to pick from a few health care plans designed by government bureaucrats.
Having choices we don't like is no choice at all.
They choose.
We lose.
It might seem mild by comparison, But those Harry and Louise ads were part of a successful effort to kill healthcare reform efforts during President Bill Clinton's first term. But after more than a decade of repeated attempts, and even the election of a Republican president who campaigned against Obamacare, the ACA is still the law of the land.
Okay, when you put it like that, I guess it is rather remarkable. In fact, how is it that the ACA survived a time of such intense polarization that has stalled, stopped, or killed basically all other reform efforts?
Well, Melissa, we might think of this as a lesson in policy stickiness, to use, you know, a very technical term. Big theoretical issues like the right to vote are, we know, important, but probably remote for most people. Because health insurance is personal and proximate. When Harry and Louise are sitting at that kitchen table, they aren't assessing the health of democracy. They're calculating the health of their family. The ACA ensures that their 25-year-old daughter is fully covered on their plan. It ensures that Harry can get his prostate screening. And it protects Louise from being kicked off the family plan after she survived that breast cancer scare last year. Melissa, we started with a comparison between New Zealand and the United States. But let's frame a different comparison. Think about the consequences of this pandemic if Republicans can be successful in their repeal attempts. Since March 2020, 45 million Americans have had COVID-19 and survived. And without the ACA, would they all be denied coverage by health insurers because of a pre-existing condition?
All right, that I get. Passage of the Affordable Care Act and its survival through more than a decade of significant and consistent attempts to dismantle it. That's a political and a policy win, clearly. We can look at the numbers and statistics about improved coverage or your point about what would America be right now without ACA in a pandemic. But I gotta say, I wonder if Americans experience it this way. Kind of your point about the kitchen table, right? I mean, on a daily basis for people living in this pandemic, I wonder if health insurance feels like a safety net. So to kind of try to figure that out, we asked the Takeaway community, and here's some of what we heard.
For most of the last 20 years or so, I've worked in small nonprofit organizations with limited budgets, so having health insurance was hit or miss. Some of them provided some insurance. Often I had to find insurance on my own. I was working for a small organization when the ACA was passed, and that was the way that I got insurance. I have to say, based on my salary at that organization, it was a bit pricey for me to try to have insurance, but I needed to have it, and it was the first time I was able to see a doctor in years. Now that I've been out of work, I get Medicaid through the ACA in New York State, and at this time, it's free. But I would like to have more robust insurance and have more choices. If possible, and hopefully my next employer will be able to provide the insurance rather than the burden being on me.
Hi, my name is Deb from Beaverton, Oregon. I have health insurance because I pay for it myself. I had to retire at the age of 63 because my back quit working out for me, and now I pay for my own insurance. It costs me $825 a month for my medical insurance, which is a good deal compared to what most people get. But I am living on pensions and Social Security, and I am eating through my meager savings to pay for my health insurance. So is it affordable? Yes, for now I can afford it. Is it rational for me to have to pay that kind of money? I don't think so.
So I think affordable is a little bit subjective because people wouldn't know it, but I couldn't afford very much. When I am faced with a medical emergency and my insurance doesn't cover all or much of what I'm being asked to pay for, I have to ask a family member for help.
Hi, this is Karen in Maple Grove, and my partner and I get our insurance through the Affordable Care Act and Minnesota Care. We have a UCare plan, and honestly, without it, I don't know how we would have survived, period. I am a small business owner, and insurance otherwise is completely unaffordable. And as we are approaching our retirement age, that is one of our top priorities, obviously.
And we have to say we noticed a trend with one particular group, Medicare recipients.
Alan Tomko, Parma, Ohio. I've got Medicare A and B and supplemental plan N. Cost me $250 a month. And I go to the Cleveland Clinic where I get incredible care. I feel like I'm getting $1 million care there. They're wonderful. Number two hospital in the United States. I wouldn't move because of that hospital. They take wonderful care of me.
Richard Blasey, Wimberley, Texas. Yes, I have health insurance. I've been on Medicare for about 4 years now, and I couldn't be happier. I don't know what the problem is with Medicare for All, but all for it.
The enthusiasm that we heard from Alan and Richard is shared by the overwhelming majority of Medicare recipients. A 2021 study from the Kaiser Family Foundation found that 94% of adults 65 and older with Medicare coverage report being very satisfied or satisfied with the quality of their medical care and the availability of specialists. So to echo Richard, why not just implement Medicare for All?
My name is Peter Suderman, and I'm the features editor at Reason Magazine.
Now, Peter thinks of health insurance reform quite differently.
Well, I think too often people make the mistake of assuming that the government should be involved in the provision of health insurance simply because the government already does so much of that. We have Medicare, Medicaid, Obamacare. We have a tax incentive for employer-sponsored health insurance. And what Republicans have mostly talked about doing for the last 20 years or so is tinkering around the edges. And so what I would like to see politicians, especially on the right, do is think about peeling back layers and trying to have fewer of them rather than expanding the system that we already have, and rather than trying to patch together, create patches for the existing fractured system. Because right now what we have is a very fractured healthcare system. And just about all of the reform proposals on the table that aren't single payer are designed to accept that fragmentation and then build from there.
Is there a way to really begin to peel back those layers without starting to step right on your constituents if you're a Republican or a Democratic lawmaker?
It's a great question. I think that if you are trying to start from scratch, the first thing you want to do is eliminate the tax preference for employer-sponsored health insurance. And then you want to think about what the government's role really should be in healthcare. And to me, the government's role should be helping the people who need it most. And Medicare, for example, which is the biggest program in the United States, doesn't do that. It's targeted at seniors and it's age-based. And seniors are a relatively wealthy cohort.
See, and right at this moment, I kind of felt like I should stop Peter, because he just dismantled employer-based health insurance and Medicare in a single swipe.
Yeah, but listen, you gotta respect Reason Magazine writers, Melissa. They are honey badgers.
Honey badger don't care. Just takes what it wants. Oh my God, watch it dig. Look at that digging.
Pitching ideas because they think they're right, not because they are politically palatable.
That's the truth. Reason don't give a damn.
So we are just a few years away from Medicare becoming insolvent in one of its biggest trust funds. And that means that come 2026, Medicare is not going to be able to pay all of its bills to hospitals and to many healthcare providers. And that's going to create care issues for the seniors who rely on it. And so to me, that sounds like a program that is not working.
Why not just raise that ceiling, make Medicare solvent by putting more resources into the pot?
There's a limit to how much the government can simply spend money to fix these problems. And at a certain point, these programs are going to become so expensive that simply spending more money is going to create issues like inflation that are both political and economic problems, pocketbook issues for middle-class Americans. And so at some point, that spending is going to have to come under control. And right now, it's really remarkably not much of a political issue, right? That this is not something that Joe Biden and Donald Trump, which admittedly was a strange presidential race, but it wasn't something where the presidents were arguing about this during the presidential debates in 2020. And yet, whoever is in the White House in 2026 is going to face this. And I think Americans just aren't ready for the fact that Medicare is about to run out of the money that has been allocated for it by the federal government in pretty short order.
It's surprising just how hard it is to imagine a robust policy debate on a substantive issue between the political parties. But Peter outlined what it could look like.
I think it really just starts with two things. And one is that Democrats need to understand that resources, even for healthcare, are not unlimited. Those commitments eventually create problems when those programs become insolvent or are about to become insolvent, as is the case with Medicare. Now, Republicans have a different problem, which is that they don't care very much about healthcare policy at all. The last time a Republican administration actually tried to move forward or even really think deeply about a healthcare reform was the George W. Bush administration. There was some movement towards individual accounts and health savings accounts. But even there, it was really a second or third order concern for Republicans. Because Republicans have largely given up on the idea of substantive healthcare policy being something that they run on. Instead, what they do is they say Democratic policies are bad. And in many cases, I would agree with that. I think that many Democratic policies on healthcare are quite flawed. At the same time, it's not enough to simply say that Democratic policies are bad, because Republicans are also going to have to, if they win elections, face up to the problems that exist already in the healthcare system we have, again, taking us back to this issue of path dependency that Republicans are just totally ignoring.
We knew that after cataloging many of the problems in our system, we wanted to discuss solutions. So we called up a member of Congress who has been working diligently to find solutions.
My name is Pramila Jayapal. I am the Congresswoman for Washington's 7th Congressional District.
Like all of our guests, Representative Jayapal pointed to the problem of fragmentation in our system. And I asked her if that fragmentation maps onto political power.
Yes, it does. And it also simultaneously is obviously mapping onto race and ethnicity, because the way the system works is Black Americans, Latinos, and Indigenous people are much more likely to be uninsured. They are also obviously much more likely to have their vote suppressed or to not be in the halls of power and to be seen as having political power, not being catered to by the current political system, let's put it that way. Why couldn't we just ensure that the government provides the health insurance system? And we still use our existing network of doctors and hospitals, but you never have to worry that if you're tossed out of a job, that you're now going to be without health insurance. And if you happen to be amongst the category of people that are politically not seen to have power or not be catered to, or you happen to be a person of color or a low-income person, that you simply aren't going to be able to get any of your health care costs covered.
Now, the Congresswoman has been a leading Democrat on this issue and one of the authors of Medicare for All.
I think what we have to continue to do is, number one, help people to fight for the fact that they deserve health care. And number two, present a comprehensive vision, which is what my Medicare for All bill, when I introduced it, it was the first time that we had had a comprehensive vision of what a Medicare for All system would look like, whatever you want to call it, and then also how we would transition to it. And I think that that detail, while it leaves open the possibility that people are going to strike at little things that they don't like, I think it is important because people need to feel secure that they're going to have healthcare. And a lot of the counter to changing our healthcare system comes from the fact that people, the opposition, the lobbyists, the big pharmaceutical companies, the big health insurance, private health insurance companies, they prey on people's fear that you're actually going to lose healthcare. And so then we just point to the VA, we point to the Medicare system, and we say, no, actually, we're enrolling millions of new people into Medicare every day. And we could easily turn that into the system that we're talking about because it is already in operation and it is working very well, except that we need to even expand the Medicare system to cover more things. And so that is also contained within Medicare for All. Just adding dental, vision, and hearing to our current Medicare would be the part of the Medicare for All bill that is about improving current Medicare as we know it.
Dental, vision, and hearing. Representative Jayapal is definitely taking these dives deeper. And we asked her to say more about this crucial point.
This is something we hear about all the time from seniors. Imagine the irony of the fact that as you get older, we know that with aging comes a decrease in vision, a decrease in hearing, the need for hearing aids, and increased issues with dental care. And right now, Medicare and many health insurance programs, actually, but certainly Medicare, does not cover hearing aids. It does not cover most of dental. It does not cover eyeglasses. And it makes no sense at all because these are also, if you look at dental as an example, it is very much tied to diabetes and other serious illnesses that cost a lot of money. And so if we just covered comprehensive dental and vision and hearing for our elders, it would make an enormous difference to the quality of life, to increased, you know, to decreasing incidence of things like dementia. They have found, the research has found that if you can't hear, you move into a state of dementia much more quickly. It makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. And so these are the things that we could do right now. And frankly, they don't cost very much money at all because you pay much more into the system if you allow these conditions to continue to escalate. But most importantly, it's about human dignity. You know, as you get old, you should be able to see, you should be able to hear, you should be able to have your teeth and eat and enjoy these last years. So that is what we were pushing in the Build Back Better Act. And, you know, unfortunately, there is still resistance even to those ideas.
Basic human dignity. I know that's right, Melissa. And it's also about what families deserve.
If we had the kind of system that we're talking about, like with a Medicare for All system or a government health insurance system, whatever you want to call it, it would save 98% of families money on their healthcare costs, thousands in savings for some. And that cannot be underestimated, just how much the lack of money just in your pocket affects people's ability to live. And I think what we want is families who feel like they can prioritize their health and who feel like they're not going to be pitting a healthcare cost, you know, whether it's a cancer treatment or diabetes treatment, against a housing cost or against the cost of food on the table, you know, that you wouldn't have grandma cutting her prescription drugs in half at the kitchen table because she can't possibly afford the entire prescription as it has been assigned. And so I just think that is a really, really important point, is how this affects the pocketbooks and the mental health and happiness of families across our country.
Dorian, thanks so much for joining me on this deep dive. I am glad to have you back, even if it means you had to leave the land of sunshine and single-payer system.
Melissa, our dives are always an adventure. And before we go, I think we should highlight one more call from the Takeaway community. Javon called from Tampa, Florida, with a message that resonated for me.
Yes, I do have health care. I actually see myself as being exceptionally fortunate because 100% of the cost of my health care for me and my family, the premiums are covered by my employer. I happen to work for a labor union that takes seriously its values about the idea that everybody should have health care. We've seen recently that all over the country, organized workers have been able to make major gains in the benefits and their treatment in the workplace at John Deere, Kellogg's, or more recently Starbucks. I would encourage every working person to start organizing. Unions are built by regular, everyday people. and they secure the rights that regular, everyday people need, like healthcare.
You know how I feel about organizing. If the system doesn't work, there's always something we can do about it. Organize, organize, organize.
Okay, can y'all tell that my friend Dorian is a labor union scholar and a third-generation community organizer? Well, that's our show for today. We hope that you learned as much as we did. Thank you to all of our guests, Professor Julia Lynch, Professor Jamila Mishner, Dr. Zeke Emanuel, Peter Suderman, and Representative Pramila Jayapal. And a big thanks to the team here at The Takeaway who grind day and night to make this show. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.